It's been days since the top diplomats from the major world powers in Iran are in Switzerland trying to find common ground to reach to some sort of deal regarding Iran's nuclear program. At this moment of time, we don't know the outcome, but series of extension of deadlines and huge diplomatic traffic around the globe shows that they are up to something serious behind the door. It makes me to think that even if the deal does not come through at this time, a lot of energy already being invested, there might be something to follow soon. Of course, the deal, if happens, will open many doors, not only to Iran, also for its landlocked Central Asian neighbors. And this is what we would like to discuss today. I am Mohammed Tahir, Director of Turkmen Service at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Joining me on the phone is Alex Watanka, Middle Eastern Affairs Expert at Washington-based Middle East Institute. Hussein Aryan, London-based Iranian expert. Here in the studio, I have Nisha Bograti, chief editor at Radio Ferda, the Iranian service of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and Bruce Panier, editor of Kishlak Awazi, a Central Asia blog at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Welcome, gentlemen, to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Mr. Bograti, you are having busy time.
Oh, pretty much. Tell me about it.
Radio Ferda. So let me come to you first to you. If you're commitments dictates you to you need to leave us, you can anytime during the show.
I wouldn't miss the chance.
Correct. My first question would be to you, Mr. Bograti, what's happening in Lausanne?
Well, you know, as you said, a lot of activity and at the same time, a lot of despair and a lot of long expectations from the journalists who have been waiting there, including our own correspondent in the field on the ground. But as you said, it's a very intense negotiation. It's one of the longest single setting of negotiations that a U.S. Secretary of State has had, at least during a long period of time. Well, what we're hearing right now is that it is not going to be the final deal, of course, but there will be a sort of an agreement which will state that the negotiations, the whole body of negotiations have led to some concrete agreement, but there would be details that would be worked out during the coming 3 months. We're expecting that. The words from the ground say that most probably there would be such an agreement, such an initial agreement announced this evening, but we're not sure. That's what we heard the first day. Still, the negotiations are going on after that for 48 hours.
Obviously, we would like to look at this Iranian discussion from the Central Asian perspective, but first of all, we need to also unpack what's happening there. Alex, I'm coming to you. It's unprecedented, as Nisha said in his statement, that the first time Iranian and American top diplomats are coming together in spending so much time together to discuss this issue in the past, even that they could not come together. What is that Washington wants here? What pushes Washington to come into this stage?
I mean, the Iranian nuclear program has, since it was sort of uncovered back in 2002, become one of the key security challenges for the United States, not just this current President Obama, but also his predecessor, President Bush, had to wrestle with this question for a very long time. And the simple answer to why this concern is there is, one, the nature of the threat, the idea of proliferation, a nuclear weapon in a very unstable part of the world called the Middle East. In the event that Iran has a nuclear weapon, what would that do to American interests in the Middle East? And again, people have to be remembering that going back to Jimmy Carter, President Carter, back in the 70s, the idea of stability in the Middle East has been one of the key issues in American foreign policy. Now, when you introduce the idea of a nuclear weapon to the picture, you just make it so much more complicated. And the other thing that is obviously pushing this agenda forward as far as American foreign policy is concerned is the nature of the Islamic Republic, and as we heard before, 36 years of hostile relations between Washington and Tehran. So combined, the fact that you have on the one hand a very sensitive issue, a nuclear potential nuclear weapon in a very unstable and yet extremely strategically important part of the world. And then on the other hand, you have Iran at the heart of it, a country that has probably been one of the most nagging issues for successive American presidents. Makes it not just sensitive, but potentially consequential issue. So that's why the Americans are in this, talking to the Iranians as long as they have, because the potential stakes are so high. Obviously, at the moment, everybody's, at least in the White House, hoping that a deal can be reached. And the big question comes the day after the deal has been reached, if it is reached, which is, how can you build on this compromise? Because an agreement over Iran's nuclear program in any way will only be the sort of the beginning of a much harder journey to come after, which is about building political trust between Iran and the United States in particular. That's not going to be easy, but before you can get there, you need to at least have a solution to Iran's nuclear file.
Yeah, and Mr. Aryan, from the Iranian perspective, if the deal is reached, the Iranian perspective is this. I mean, they would like to have sanctions lifted as soon as possible. What are the potential areas where Iran might see some sort of easing sanction? What are the first things in the line, in the list?
Well, as we heard from Alex, this is going to be a long process because after this negotiation, which is going on now, hopefully, you know, we all hope that there will be some kind of roadmap so they can agree on principles. But after that, to work out the details of how they're going to implement it and what sort of actions that each side has to take, that is, from the Iranian side and also from 5+1, that is going to be a long process. Establishing confidence, establishing trust, it's going to be long, considering Iran's domestic politics and also various factions, especially a particular faction that is still against establishing ties with the United States. But that could be a kind of coexistence and continue and hopefully lead to some kind of solid ties between Iran and the United States. But this would provide Iran tremendous opportunities. I think one particular area, in my opinion, that Iran will be interested, you know, in terms of sanctions being lifted, would be in the domain of energy, where Iran would be able to absorb foreign investment, where that would give Iran a real boost in terms of its economy.
Right. And here, where the Central Asians have some stake in this discussion, because the landlocked neighbors of Iran, the Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, and several other stands there, they also looking for ways to export their energy towards the Western market. Bruce, if the positive result is coming out, what does it mean to Central Asia?
It would mean a dramatic redrawing of the energy export map in the region, without a doubt. You know, for the Central Asian republics have been independent almost 25 years now. And for all that time, Iran was a route that they couldn't even consider. You know, I mean, there's been some trade between Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan does ship some gas. There's some oil swap deals between Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan and Iran, which actually have been excluded from the sanctions list by the Western powers. But when the Central Asians were looking to figure out how they would get their gas, their oil, other products out to markets in the world, Iran was just practically a barrier. There was no possibility of using that as a route. So they've had to come up with all these other elaborate schemes, which really haven't borne any fruit to date. You know, we have the TAPI pipeline that's going down and you know, supposedly through Afghanistan, Pakistan, and into India. And, of course, the Trans-Caspian pipeline, which has been out there for 20 years now, you know, to bring Turkmen gas across the bottom of the Caspian to Azerbaijan. And that shows you just how desperate the situation was as far as energy export routes. The far easier and cheaper route would be to build a pipeline across northern Iran and ship gas or oil, for that fact, through there. there, but you know, it's been totally off limits since then. So should we get to a point, and it looks likely to happen within the next 5 or 10 years, where Iran is back, is suddenly in the game, then it presents all kinds of new opportunities for the Central Asians to get their products to the market. And this is especially important now, because Central Asia has been kind of backed into a corner. You know, they've been shipping, at the start they were shipping all their gas and oil through Russia. Well, Russia has oil and gas too, so that, it was a competitor as well as being the transit country for them. Russia's been taking less of that. It's hard economic times in Russia, and they've been shifting in the last 6-7 years to China. But the result of that has been almost a monopoly customer effect, where China is now the main customer, and they don't really have any other options. So Iran coming back into the game as a potential transit country opens up the doors to Europe all of a sudden and changes everything as far as the energy export potential of Central Asia.
Right. Alex, here I want to come back to you. You had a really interesting piece recently on Al Monitor, I believe, about the potential outcome of positive outcome of this discussion. What does it mean to Central Asia? Other than energy, what do you see that this kind of potential opportunity I'm talking here, hypocritically, obviously, if the positive result comes out from Lausanne, what does it mean other than energy to Central Asia?
I think Bruce just earlier put the scene so wonderfully in front of us. I mean, we have to look at this in terms of geopolitics. If you are one of the Central Asian states, one of the five countries that's been independent since 1991, you have faced yourself to the north with the giant that is Russia and another giant to your east called China. And for a long time, you wanted to break that geopolitical grip that China and Russia have over you. And your only really way to the world markets has been through Iran. But again, as Bruce pointed out, Iran was off limits for the last quarter of a century. The Central Asians haven't been able to consider Iran as a real viable partner for one simple reason. Whenever they wanted to deal with Iran, they had to overcome American objections, and that has proven almost impossible. Now we get into a point where America might not object anymore, and this is exactly why you see from Astana to Ashgabat an interest in reconsidering you know, what Iran can do for them geopolitically to lessen their reliance on countries like Russia and China. Again, nobody wants to be totally reliant on one or two neighbors, and that's exactly where the Central Asian states have found themselves. So I think this is a pivotal moment for them. And it's obviously energy is what catches all the headlines, and rightly so, because that's by and large what at the moment Central Asia has to offer to the world markets, its energies, minerals, and so forth. But that can change. That can change, and Iran could be a key player in bringing about that change. Let me just point to one specific area where you see perhaps change, which is what the Central Asian states for a long time have wanted to do, which is to become a hub between Europe and the Far East. We've heard over the last many years, you know, lots of suggestions about how to revive the old Silk Road of the ancient times. Hasn't really made much of an impact so far, despite the many plans. But if you bring Iran into it, and if Washington decides that Iran is a legitimate player and America is not going to sanction anyone that cooperates with Iran, then we've already seen last December, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Iran launched the latest phase of a rail network, and I think we can expect more of such infrastructure in play. So It's an indirect development. It's a development where Central Asia, together with Iran, make themselves a hub between Europe and the Far East, but also Central Asia and the extremely wealthy states of the Persian Gulf. Remember, Oman and the Emiratis, they're also sitting waiting for investment opportunities, but also to use Central Asia as a way of trading with the other countries on the Eurasian landmass. So I think I wouldn't expect immediately billions of Iranian investment going into Central Asia or billions of Central Asian money going into Iran. That's not what I think we should be looking for development. It's once the energy side has been taken care of in terms of Iran becoming an outlet for countries like Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan. The next phase is infrastructure in terms of road and rail, and many countries in the region would benefit from that kind of integration because, and this is my last point, if you look at Middle East, Central Asia, economic integration between these two blocks is actually very limited. More trade will help them build up confidence, and that's key. Central Asian states fundamentally have been disappointed when they have looked at the Islamic world, not just Iran, but also the Gulf states. Mm-hmm. Whenever they looked at the Islamic world, they wanted economic ties, and instead they got ideology, which they don't want. They don't want Islamism in Central Asia. But I think we can flip that argument. If you focus on economics, then you make the Central Asian states so much more comfortable, and I think that's where the emphasis ought to be on economics.
We will discuss that subject a little bit later, but first, Nisha, it's a positive news that if agreement is reached with a positive outcome, Iran is going to be hub for Central Asian energy to follow through it and to reach to Europe. But there's a problem, in my opinion, what to do with time-to-time Iranian-Turkish tension. How does it going to play out?
Well, I think that would be an entire different issue than the current negotiations which is going on right now. I think that's the power play which is in place right now, not only as rightfully as you put it, between Iranians and the Turkish side, but also the Iranian and all the players of the region. So I think with the regional tensions mounting currently, and with the situation specifically in Yemen right now, and especially given the tough stance that we saw, for example, from Erdogan, which was somehow unprecedented, I think that would not change the big picture of the whole power play. I suppose that Iran would even be granted a higher hand indirectly in regional affairs if the deal comes off as they want to. And I think that part of the story, the power struggle between Iran, Arab Saudi Arabia, Turkey, in regards with Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, will stay in place. So I don't see in near future that the deal, even if it's reached as desired by Islamic Republic of Iran, would have a huge impact on those equations.
Mr. Aryan, still we are talking about that there might be some positive result coming out from that discussion. If that is the case, one of the losers will be Russia, because the Central Asian energy at this moment has to go through Russia, wherever it has to go. And Russia has a dominant say on that. So if Russia is going to lose that, how it is going to react into that kind of situation outcome?
First of all, I don't think it's going to be we shouldn't think that this is going to happen, in a couple of years or so. Because by the time a solid agreement reached between Iran and P5+1 and a kind of reasonable relationship between Iran and the United States, and also the attraction of foreign investment, it will take at least 5-6 years, I imagine, before anything can happen in terms of transfer of energy. Okay, all these countries are now, hoping that the North and South Corridor and East and West, will develop. But in terms of transfer of energy, that would be, a sort of medium term. Imagine if Iran had the, appropriate investment, even wanted to send some of its energy to Europe. That will be, 5 years, 6 years, even it might take more. And in that case, it's not necessarily going to be, if they have the right policy, going to be a kind of hostile approach between Iran and Russia. They could cooperate if need be, you know, in terms of transferring the energy. In terms of relationship between Iran and Russia, at the moment, you know, there's cooperating, but it's because of the actual needs. How it's going to develop in the future, we have to wait and see, really.
Right. Still, as I said, and I continue to mention that because of the situation today, that we don't know what is going to come out from Lausanne, but we have been discussing this issue for several days now in our editorial meetings, and some of my colleagues also pointed out that some authorities in Iranian Islamic Republic act like if positive deal is somehow coming out. For example, the recent visit of Rouhani to Turkmenistan, he's been talking about lots of these projects and increasing the Iranian-Turkmen trade 16-fold or something. You know, this train is going to Turkmenistan and then Kazakhstan. They are acting like if Iran is going to be a player, and a central player, efforts on the Tehran's behalf to increase its influence in Central Asia is already there. Where do you see, Bruce, it is going from this stage in case if I'm saying this result is positive from there?
Well, you know, at least in the case, and I had mentioned briefly that there are some energy arrangements already between Kazakhstan and Iran and between Turkmenistan and Iran. So there's kind of a foundation there for cooperation already. And I cannot remember, I think it's Zarif who is supposed to go to Kazakhstan sometime within the next 2 weeks, actually. And you can count on the fact that this is going to be one of the topics of conversation, as it was when Rouhani went to Turkmenistan, there's a good chance we're going to open up for business here pretty soon, and we can do a lot more trade. So the Central Asians actually do have, you know, like I said, the basic building blocks for trade with Iran already are in place, and especially Turkmenistan, which has gotten all kinds of, like I said, exemptions earlier. There are two gas pipelines that connect them. I see that there's, you know, they don't have the kind of distrust of Iran that some of these other countries have. It's a regional neighbor, even if it was one that they couldn't build extremely close ties with. It is a neighbor, and they do have experience dealing with them. So, there's something there that's already started, and that's going to help them going forward without a doubt, because it's not like they have to build everything from scratch or start from the beginning or something. The basic principles of, you know, bilateral, multilateral relations are already in place. And, you know, you've mentioned the railroad. The one that goes from Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan to Iran is only the first of those. The Chinese have another one that they also want to build, too, that involves countries further to the east, but starts in Iran, goes Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, and then into China. So, you know, we see the building blocks are there. The Central Asians, to a great extent, have shed some of the distrust, and some countries I would exclude, Uzbekistan and one, but generally speaking, the Central Asians seem to view Iran in a very different way than the Europeans or the Americans have viewed Iran. So I see huge potential there. I don't think it'll be so hard for them to get along. The question, you know, and our other guests have already mentioned, the biggest problem is going to be trying to convince Western neighbors that Central Asian-Iranian cooperation represents absolutely no threat, either politically or economically, to their interest. Now, in the case of Europe, that's going to be very easy, of course, because the Europeans want gas and oil, and Iran, both a supplier and transit country, has got that. So they'll probably be easy to persuade. The Americans might be a little less easy to persuade. At the end of the day, If these things do come through, it's going to be a huge economic boost to Iran, and they're going to go on a massive spending spree, I would imagine. But the officials in Iran have already, as you mentioned, signaled that they believe that this deal is coming forward, not just government officials like Rouhani. And remember, Rouhani spoke on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly with the Austrian president last year and pitched Iran as a transit route, and officials in Iran, both in the government and in the oil industry and gas industry, have also pitched this deal very recently and said that, you know, we're about to be open for business and we're ready. They've said that to the Central Asians. They've said that to the Europeans. Yeah. So, they seem to feel it's gonna be a deal pretty soon, and they're going to, like I said, open for business very soon.
So the point I wanted to raise here, actually, it goes to Alex, to you. It's something very close to what you mentioned in your article. If we look at the example of Afghanistan, when the Taliban regime was collapsed, lots of countries moved in, including Iran, And now we see some complaints from the Afghan side that Iran is kind of influencing to the society in various different forms, including political, building universities, building cultural centers or the religious institutions there. Do you think, should we have this kind of fear when Iran will have more role, increased role in Central Asia, Alex, and what that Central Asian would react into that?
If we take the last 25 years of Iranian interaction with the Central Asian neighbors, then the evidence that Iran is trying to export its Islamic revolution is actually very thin. When I talk to Central Asian experts, they point to the Gulf states, they point to Pakistan far more than they point to Iran. All the Central Asian states dislike foreigners from the Islamic world bringing their version of Islam to the unique parts of Central Asia. But they don't necessarily look at Iran as the biggest guilty party in that regard. How would I put it? I would put it to you this way. I think the Iranians, for two simple reasons, have not moved into Central Asia in the way they could have done ideologically. One, I think fundamentally is because they have always respected Russia's so-called near abroad. They do not want to go into what used to be the former Soviet Union because they don't want to anger Moscow. I think that is true for Central Asia. I also think that is true for the South Caucasus. If you look what Iran has done in Azerbaijan, a country that's extremely close to Iran, culturally, religiously, the Iranians have not done what they have done elsewhere. I mean, if you look at what Iran does today in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Bahrain or Yemen, you cannot compare the investments the Iranians have made in the Arab world, compare that to what they've done in Central Asia. In Central Asia, Iran has decided to basically stay away from its ideological agenda. And it's not just Hassan Rouhani, it's a long history, almost going back 25 years. Maybe in the beginning of the 1990s, up to about 95, there was an Iranian attempt to export its ideology, but that very quickly stopped as soon as the Russians basically said, we don't want to see this in our backyard. The Iranians have stopped. But fundamentally, what I think all the speakers are hinting at is, what would the post-nuclear deal Iran look like? And that takes us to the debate inside Tehran. Who will win that foreign policy debate? If you go back to the summer of 2013, I remember sitting in the region watching the debate among the Iranian presidential candidates, and they all agreed, from the far hardliner to the moderate in Hassan Rouhani, everyone agreed Iran has to change its foreign policy behavior and make bridges to neighbors. But the question is Hassan Rouhani, who became the president, is he going to be allowed to be the bridge builder that he wants to be? Because there are hardliners in Tehran today, around Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei, who basically look at the nuclear talks as a transactional process. We will give you, in terms of concessions, what you want as far as our nuclear program is concerned. In return, we want certain sanctions removed. But after that, we go back to where we were before. We're not going to become friends just because we reach a nuclear deal. That's what the hardliners want. And if that is true, then I suspect the Central Asian states will continue to be suspicious. So if I was a Central Asian leader, I would pay attention to who wins that foreign policy debate, because in Tehran, there are people with very different worldviews. Hassan Rouhani, he said it himself, and most powerfully in his speech in January of 2014 in Davos, he wants to bring Iran back into the international mainstream. The nuclear issue is just one big step towards Iran coming back to the world community, whereas the hardliners are saying we need to provide concessions on the nuclear issue out of necessity, but otherwise our regional policy will not change. And I think certainly, if I was Central Asia, I would hope that it's the moderates in Hassan Rouhani's government who will win that very critical foreign policy debate. And that would be a debate they are more likely to win in the event that a nuclear agreement is signed one of these days.
Whoever wins that debate, Mr. Wotanka. I like to be optimistic, but I'm not at the stage that the Iran is not going to be a democracy in 10 or 15 years. And Central Asian leaders or the Central Asian governments, they continue to, you know, stick, let's say, with problems, issues in transition to the democracy. So the more closer ties between Central Asia and Iran, more Iranian influence in Central Asia, how does it going to help, or in a positive or negative way, in their struggle to establish a rule of law, a democratic state institution in Central Asia? If you like, Mr. Bograti, you can jump in, or Mr. Arian, both of you are.
I just wanted to add something to what Alex said. The, you know, grand strategy of Iran in the region, as I said before, is not going to be discussed here within these negotiations, and definitely it's not going to change. Sure. The thing is that the kind of power struggle inside Iran that we're facing right now is somewhat unknown to even the very experts who are following the Iranian international relations and security issues closely, because it's changing pretty rapidly according to, you know, what is in front of the supreme leader and the you know, whole board of trustees there. Mm-hmm. For example, the policy which is following Iran pursuing right now in the region, especially in Iraq and Syria, might not even be discussed with Hassan Rouhani or his cabinet. Might be not, you know, we don't know. Yeah. General Qasem Soleimani, for example, the head of Quds operation of IRGC, would be much more eligible talking about that issue than Hassan Rouhani, unfortunately. So I just wanted to make it clear that, you know, these two issues, as integrated as they seem to be, they are somewhat pretty much separate from each other.
Mr. Arian, I will come back to my earlier question. The scenario of increased Iranian and Central Asian relationship, how it's going to play out in a struggle of Central Asian people, citizens, I would say, to achieve democracy, rule of law in their country.
You know, as we heard from Alex, I think Iran's main interest in Central Asia would be, you know, economic interests. I don't think, to be honest, that Iran would have any influence as such towards the process of liberalization or democratization in Central Asia, because Iran, you know, itself has a long way, you know, to move in that direction. It can't be, you know, a model as such, you know, for Central Asian countries. But hopefully, I look at it from a sort of different perspective. If there is an improvement, you know, in terms of relations between Iran and P5+1, and also a better relationship in the sphere of economy with Central Asian countries, that might ease the kind of uncertainty that exists at the moment. That might help one of the major issues between Iran and also the Caspian states to resolve issues such as Caspian Sea and the legal regime of the Caspian Sea. Although Rouhani, as we heard, had made steps to improve relationship with, say, for instance, Turkmenistan, you know, made the journey there and also made sort of took a better stance towards Azerbaijan. And we also heard all kind of optimism after Astrakhan summit how to resolve the issue in the Caspian Sea. You know, that might help this process, and we might see a kind of, you know, more stable environment and less uncertainty in the Caspian region, and hopefully that might stop the process of militarization in the Caspian Sea, because at the moment, in spite of all these efforts have been made, all countries are working very hard to improve their naval power, especially in the Caspian Sea, and that cannot help the stability in the country, and also in terms of the development of, you know, energy sector in the Caspian Sea as well.
Right. Bruce, you want to jump in? I'm not going to give even question to you, please.
Yeah. I just wanted to say that, you know, I mean, we've had heard a lot of stuff, which is absolutely true. Iran is not going to become a democratic pro-Western state within a few years after this. It certainly the easing of the sanctions will help the economic situation in Central Asia, but it does introduce something else. Iran is a strong partner of Central Asia. You could make the argument that it gives them, the Central Asian governments, an extra ally in international events to shield themselves from criticism. In the past, what we've seen is when there have been problems in Central Asia, violence or something, when they get criticized by the West, they turn to Russia and China as their protectors and say, you know, that these guys are going to help us out and side with us on this. Now they get an extra guy in there, too, which would be Iran. So that you know, when they do commit human rights abuses or repression against their own population or something like that, they can count not only on Beijing and Moscow to come to their aid in the United Nations and other international organizations, but they'll be able to count on Iran to side with them, too. There's also a possible destabilizing factor in Iran playing a bigger influence in the region, and that is the fact that Iranians are much closer to Tajiks than they are to anybody else in the region. They're both Persian peoples. The other peoples are Turkic for the most part. Now, Iranian-Tajik relations are already very, very good, and Iran's helping out with many big projects in Tajikistan right now. We've already seen that Uzbekistan objects to that, particularly as concerns the hydropower projects. They blocked the route from Iran into Tajikistan by rail, and they have again and again tried to sabotage Iranian-Tajik relations. In a more open, with better ties with Iran, it will become a lot more difficult for Uzbekistan to do that. But at the same time, like I said, the Tajiks, the immediate winner of better relations with Iran in Central Asia would be the Tajiks. It kind of upsets the current relationship. And I'm not saying that it would be a bad thing, certainly not for Tajikistan, but it does introduce an element which has been there. It reinforces an element that's been there, and it could have. It could create tensions between Tajikistan and some of the other countries somewhere further down the line.
Right. It's already 45 minutes. This is the time when we finish our discussion. Unless you, one of our guests, have a final note to say, floor is open for that, with the final comments.
If I may, Mohammed, just sure. A quick point I wanted to make in our discussions about the future of Central Asia. One of the potentials that we need to watch out for is warming of relations between Russia and Iran and what that might do for Iran's ability to become more of a player in the former Soviet South. In the past, the Russians have not wanted any players to operate in that part of the world, jealously guarded against it. At one point, the Iranians, the Turks, came in the 1990s. They were not successful. The sort of two major players that have had more or less success are China and obviously Russia itself. The United States, that's a big question mark. I don't think the U.S. has done what it could have done in Central Asia. But the fundamental point here is if Russia continues to fall out with the West over Ukraine, and if Russia continues to want to look for alternative partners because of what is going on there in terms of sanctions and other isolation, then it would look like a country that would benefit from closer ties with another foe or a rival of the West, which is Iran in this case. So look out for the September summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Is Iran going to be allowed to become a full member? What else could they do to bring Russian-Iranian relations closer? And that could have an impact on Central Asia. Already, we are seeing almost a green light for Iran to become a more of an economic play in Armenia. And if that is also going to be repeating itself elsewhere in Central Asia, that might be an indirect way for Iran to gain more influence, something that it couldn't do before because there was the Russian opposition to that. But if that Russian opposition goes away, then that might be opening the doors for Iran in Central Asia as well.
there might be some signal of how it's going to develop in the future from Russian position in these Lausanne talks. But again, that's another long story that if we get in, we will end up discussing that subject. So thank you very much, Alex Wotanka from Middle East Institute, Hussein Aryan, an independent expert from London. My colleagues here, Nisha Bograti from Radio Ferda and Bruce Panier from Central Newsroom. And I am Mohammed Tahir from Turkmen Service. It has been a fascinating discussion. Thank you very much, colleagues.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you.